The Curve Crew are back. It's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Twenty-five minutes before the top of the hour, you're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. It's an IC Saturday here on TSN 1290. This segment brought to you by the Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy. Always wear a mouth guard and give yourself peace of mind protection as well as facial teeth and mouth protection. For more information about the Linden Market Dental Center, visit lindenmarketdentalcenter.com. The Anaheim Ducks flamed out, losing Game 7 on home ice to the Nashville Predators. They were up 3-2 in that first round series. They lose Game 6 in Nashville. Then they lose Game 7 on home ice. Bob Murray made the decision to dismiss head coach Bruce Boudreaux as a result. Before we talk about it, here's Bob Murray talking about the performance of his team's best players.
He had to take this team to the finals, or was it just the way you guys went out?
It's the way we go out. It's the way it happens. And like everybody, let's face it. I'd like to know where the heck they were in games one and two. Like game seven, and the players are going to have to answer that in the next 4 or 5 days. Where were they? They showed up in game seven, but where was that? Where was that passion, the controlled emotion? Where the heck was that? And so they're going to have to be held accountable a little bit too.
That's Bob Murray talking about Bruce Boudreaux's dismissal as head coach, and of course talking about the best players on the Ducks, the Ryan Getzlaffs, the Corey Perrys, and the Ryan Kesslers. You know, your thoughts on Murray's comments? Is this a move he had to make, given the tumultuous season that there was in Anaheim? Another playoff disappointment after starting the year so poorly, then playing so well. Was he sort of backed into a corner and this was the only move he could make?
I don't think it was the only move he could make. I don't have an issue with the move, though. Bruce Boudreaux's done a really good job coaching talented teams and to perform well in the regular season and not putting out poor performances and, you know, missing the playoffs or just getting in and all that. The problem is when it matters most, his teams don't appear to be ready, which I think falls somewhat on the players and somewhat on him. And, you know, you can look at a different number of perspectives, okay? So you can say Bruce Boudreaux's teams have had had no success in game sevens over the past four seasons. The other perspective is his team's lost in game seven of round one 4 years ago, lost in game seven of round two 3 years ago, lost in game seven of round three last year. So his team was getting better every year. It was taking the next step every year. This year is that step back, however. And the Game 7 loss, it's different than the other Game 7 losses to Detroit, and I think more so to Los Angeles and Chicago because of the fashion in which they lost those games. They were dominated by LA and Chicago halfway through those games were over. That was not the case in Game 7 against Nashville. Anaheim was the better team that night. Now, sure, Nashville got the lead and they changed the style of play, but Anaheim didn't play poorly. But that doesn't matter when you've loaded up on Ryan Kesler, who played well long-term, and you've loaded up on your big guys, and Bomber's done a nice job not being a cap team there. But when you put in big money for this team in kind of a short-term run in mind, you can't lose in the first round to the Nashville Predators. And that's going to cost you your job because the window here is closing a little bit. Now they don't have some good young players, but they want to win now. And if Bruce Boudreaux can't get them over the hump, and he proved in Washington that he couldn't get them over the hump either, Bob Murray can't take any more chances.
Let me ask you this, as before you get in on this. I believe both of you took Nashville to win in round one.
Yeah.
So if you both were correct with your prediction, you know, isn't it sort of, you know, isn't there a bit of a disconnect in that, you know, Bruce Boudreaux had to win, you know, to keep his job and had to go far to keep his job, yet both of you thought that Nashville was going to be, you know, that it's not a stunning upset. In that, obviously, there's...
Well, most people picked Anaheim, though.
I know most people probably picked Anaheim, but, I mean, it's not like the Nashville Predators were a pushover of a team and that this is a complete, you know, a choke job by the Anaheim Ducks.
That's fair.
No, the Nashville Predators are an excellent team, and they struggled in game one of the second round versus the San Jose Sharks, and they got to play better than that. I thought San Jose was pretty dominant at times. But, guys, if you think about it, there were really troubling signs at the beginning of this season when the Anaheim Ducks were struggling, and Ryan Getzlaf had, what, one or two goals in his first 30 games. Mm-hmm. I mean, this team had an excellent finish to the season, but there were signs there earlier in the season. And to Richie's point, you know, losing to the Chicago Blackhawks last year in the conference finals, losing four consecutive game sevens at home, the Anaheim Ducks have just never been, over the last 4 or 5 years, been able to translate regular season success into the playoffs. Mm-hmm. And you've seen them at times play very well in the playoffs. I mean, Anaheim rolled over the Calgary Flames. After the Ducks swept the Jets last year, and the Jets were in that series, and they were leading a lot of those games, especially in Anaheim. But Anaheim rolled over the Calgary Flames and were doing very well against the Chicago Blackhawks. That was their year last year. I thought that, especially with the emergence of guys like Raquel and Silverberg on the second line there, I thought that that was their year, and they run into a really good Chicago team. But this year, and again, I'm a big fan of Bruce Boudreau. And whether they go with Paul McLean, who's an assistant now, or they bring in another
Paul
coach.
Paul McLean would seem like an odd fit there.
Well, I think just regardless of who they go with, they're Rich. I think Bruce Boudreau is an excellent coach, but with this team, and let's be honest, Rich, there are a lot of strong type A personalities in that dressing room. You've talked about it. Corey Perry, Ryan Getzlaf, Ryan Kesler more so than Getzlaf. Getzlaf is the captain, but Kesler and Perry, I mean, those are strong personalities. Those guys play the game with an edge. I agree with Rich. I thought Ryan Kesler was the best player for the Ducks in that series, best forward certainly, but Corey Perry, I realize he had some chances, but he didn't do anything.
No, he didn't. And he bears responsibility more so than the coach, although the coach ought to have put Getzlaf and Perry together far more than he did.
Over the years,
earlier,
Rich,
than he did.
Getzlaf and Perry have had the most success when they're together. And I understand what Bruce Boudreau is doing. He's trying to get that second line going. He's trying to get the first line going because Getzlaf didn't have his best series either, but he had rough year. I'm not sure what was going on with Getzlaf this year, but you're expecting Ryan Getzlaf to usually be in the top 10 in the NHL in scoring, and he just wasn't there this year. Mm-hmm. And I'm not just talking about the goal scoring because he's more of a guy that gets the assist. But needless to say, guys, Anaheim had the lowest goals against average in the NHL. So it's not like this team wasn't a good defensive team. And I think, you know, they kept some of the games low scoring. Mm-hmm. But against the Nashville Predators, they have a lot of offensive weapons, especially there with Ryan Johansson when he's clicking. So I think that it was kind of inevitable. And this Anaheim Ducks team, I think, needs to kind of rethink the structure of their team a little bit, because even though they're an excellent regular season team, this team just can't get it done in the playoffs.
So let's follow up on that point. We talked about it last segment with the Rangers and maybe changing some of the core. Bob Murray alluded to making changes to the roster again this offseason. You know, who do you see him maybe targeting as being on their way out? Is there anything he can really do? I mean, he's not going to touch Perry, Getzlaf, and Kesler. So how does Bob Murray sort of change this team around? Is Frederik Andersen gone and John Gibson's their number one clear-cut goaltender?
I mean, he's an asset you could trade, so sure. I mean, Cam Fowler, Sammy Vatanen, you have to sign. Those are assets you can trade. I think it'd be more a move like that. I don't see any of those big guys going. And they also have these no-move clauses.
Sure.
Kessler's kicking in shortly, the other two having theirs. So I'm not so sure. Huge changes are on the horizon. I think the coach will be a change. There may be a change on the back end and Annette, as you mentioned, but I don't see massive changes.
I think Anaheim Richie is in a very similar situation that San Jose was in, changing the coach, bringing in Pete DeBoer, firing Todd McLellan. I think Thornton, Marlowe, Pavelski, Couture, Burns, all these guys together. A lot of people were expecting San Jose to move one of those key pieces. I think, Drew, the clear strength of the Anaheim Ducks' is defense, and with the emergence of a guy like Shea Theodore, maybe they can move a Sammy Vatanen. They're certainly not moving Hampus Lindholm or Cam Fowler. I mean, those are
two. I don't know if they're not moving Cam Fowler.
I don't know. I think he's too.
They're not moving Hampus Lindholm.
They're not moving Lindholm. I would say they're not moving Lindholm or Fowler, and then you throw in a guy like Josh Manson. I mean, there's a lot of good young defensemen there, mm-hmm. and there were rumors that maybe Anaheim would move one of their defensemen to Edmonton to bring over, whether it's a Yakupov or a Nugent Hopkins. You heard there were rumors that that deal might have happened there, but, I mean, you got to make some moves, but I don't know if you necessarily have to revamp this roster. Look, they won the division, and the Anaheim Ducks haven't been able to close out those game sevens, right? That's the key. They still have an excellent. You're talking mm-hmm. about Getzlaf and Perry and Kesler and Silverberg and Cogliano is still good, even though he's getting a little bit older now. I mean, there's a lot. Raquel is an excellent player. I thought that, you know, bringing in a guy like Perron was a good move there. Jamie McGinn, he's a UFA, but he fit in there. Maybe they keep him around. I mean, there's a lot of good players on that team.
That's why them losing is cost the coach a job.
So who's the coach? Who do you think that they should be looking at as the new head coach? You don't think Paul McLean is the right fit? Or you think,
I don't really, no.
Okay, so then, you know, given the coaches, does it need to be a veteran coach working with a veteran team, or is this the opportunity to, you know, bring up a younger head coach who's, you know, promising and full of potential?
I would bring a veteran coach in with this group. As he mentions, the personalities. Young coach loses a bit of confidence. Those dominant personalities have a heyday.
Sort of how Pittsburgh and Mike Johnson didn't work.
Yes, that's fair. I would bring in a veteran coach. I don't have one off the top of my head here who I think, okay, that needs to be the guy.
Yeah.
And it does. You don't know, Drew. What if, you know, for example, it could be Ken Hitchcock could lose in the second round. He could be available. So it's hard to predict that right now.
Sure.
What happens to Daryl Sutter? I mean, he doesn't have a contract yet.
Mm-hmm.
You assume he's going to have one, but you don't know what he's going to do. So there are different guys that may become available. So I don't think that decision needs to be made right away. But I would go with a veteran coach. You don't want a young coach may lose the room necessarily, but he may be too deferential.
I think Mark Crawford is an option there. I think Mark Crawford's an option in Ottawa as well.
Mark Crawford, let me ask you about Mark Crawford. He just like didn't have much success in Vancouver, Dallas on the way out there.
Mm-hmm.
And
Dallas didn't have very good teams back then,
though. Yeah, fair enough. Has his break in going to Switzerland almost increased his stock, even though really not much has changed?
I think people have forgotten about his lousy performances the last time he was an NHL head coach.
Now, I mean, has he learned more? Sure. But I think Crawford's name is an interesting one that keeps getting brought up because the work, I'm not saying, I mean, the guy won a cup. So, hey, you know, fair enough. And he had some really good teams. But his teams before he left the NHL really did have a hard time playing defense.
Rich, you'll have to wait to see what happens with Daryl Sutter as well. He's in the last year of his contract.
Yeah.
So,
Rich mentioned that.
Oh, I've forgot that.
It was your.
I must miss that.
It was your.
Mentioned it about a minute and a half ago.
It was your weekly I'm not listening portion.
Yeah, I was reading something here. So,
all righty. On that note, let's head to break. When we come back, we're going to look at the Sharks and the Predators series. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're on the Curve, the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Two-1 lead, and just under 4.5 to go.
Clark coaching.
And Brown scores! A redirect to Couture! 3-1!
San Jose Sharks victorious in Game 1 last night against the Nashville Predators. It ends up as a 5-2 score, although that score is a little misleading as it was quite a close game.
Yeah.
until the third period, the Sharks scoring two very late goals to make it 4-2 and then 5-2. It was a tight first period, I thought. Both teams sort of feeling each other out.
There is no way that you were up after the first period.
No, I've been staying awake late. I've been staying awake to watch some of these games.
Really?
Yeah.
You were up after the first period last night.
I was up after the second period last night.
All right.
Yeah.
You went to sleep after the second period.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. You know, the game was putting me to bed at that point in time. But, this is the most Gary Bettman series, I think, ever. Second round playoff series between the San Jose Sharks and the Nashville Predators. Two teams that aren't particularly close geographic. Two teams that have really no shared hockey history, aside from they met twice in 2000, and I think they met in 2006 and 2007 in first round playoff matchups where the Sharks won easily.
Well, I remember that was one of those years. I forget if it was 6 or 7. It was the year that Nashville loaded up Forsberg and all that, but they lost. Yeah,
yeah. So
five games.
Yeah, but you know, two non-traditional hockey markets meeting in the second round of the playoffs in the Sharks and the Predators.
You know, fair enough, Drew. There, but I think the quality of play is quite good.
Yeah,
that game wasn't that exciting last night, but I do think the quality of play is good.
You know, we were talking earlier. I think this is one of those series that'll take a couple of games to really get going, given that, you know, these teams play each other, what, three times in the regular season? There's no history. There's no mutual dislike, really, yet. It'll take a couple games for that to develop. You know, I don't think, you know, the Predators really, like I said, the score was a little misleading because the Predators took the lead in the second period. They had the lead going into the third. And, you know, for a team that had played an exhausting seven-game series against the Sharks team that had been off for, you know, almost the course of a week, mm-hmm. it took the Sharks a little bit of time to get their legs under them. I think eventually the exhaustion of the Predators was too much to overcome.
Yeah, Mike Fisher scored a nice goal last night. And let's be honest here, the third period was where the game was won by the San Jose Sharks. They turned it on in the third period. It was a very close game. It wasn't the best game ever. I mean, it wasn't as good as the Pittsburgh-Washington yeah. game one for sure, but I actually thought that that was the best game of the playoffs for the Mike Ribeiro, Philip Forsberg, Craig Smith line. And Craig Smith had injury problems in the first round, but I thought Ribeiro, who was very underwhelming, I thought, in the first round versus Anaheim, it was really the Ryan Johansson, James Neal, Yarncroke line that was the best line for the Nashville Predators. But this Predators team, guys, is very reliant on offense from defense. Guys like Shea Weber and Yossi and Ryan Ellis. I thought mm-hmm. Shea Weber had one of his more difficult games against the San Jose Sharks on the winning goal. Yossi and Weber were on the ice, and they kind of there was a bit of a miscommunication there. I mean, give mm-hmm. Joel Ward credit and give the San Jose Sharks credit. I thought that they were really good using their speed in the transition game. I thought they were really good for most of the game, but especially in the third period there. And, you know, Pekka Rinne didn't have his best game, but I think this is going to be a close series. I picked the Sharks in the series, but I could make an argument for both teams winning the series. Very evenly matched teams. I would give the edge to Nashville probably in defense, on defense and in goal, but I'd give San Jose the edge when it comes to offense. And, you know, let's be honest here, guys. With Chicago and LA out of the playoffs this year, these are two teams that there is an opening for one mm-hmm. of these teams to possibly go to the Stanley Cup Finals. And mm-hmm. you look at St. Louis and Dallas, those two teams are going to beat each other up, in the other series. So I think for both of these teams, they're trying to get over that hump. Nashville, they've never been to the Stanley Cup Finals. San Jose's never been to the Stanley Cup Finals. So I think for both of these teams, I think this is a very good series. I mean, I know, again, you know, game one wasn't the best game with San Jose kind of making it, out of reach there in the third period, Drew. But, you know, there's a lot of talented players on both sides. And, you know, we should mention Colin Wilson has been fantastic in these playoffs. He's been their really best well. Offensive player.
After having a lousy regular season.
He was a scratch at times.
Yeah, so he's been very good in the playoffs. You're absolutely right there. You know, Rich, how do you see this series playing out? Is this, as you mentioned, he thinks that the Predators have the edge on defense and in goal, and the Sharks have the edge on forwards. I think I sense a disagreement.
Yeah, you know, I hear what he's saying there. I didn't love what I saw from Pekka Rinne last night. You know, at times at the beginning he was real good with that glove, but he's playing back. He's certainly relying on reflexes a lot positionally. I was at questions with him. I'm going to say I think San Jose probably has the edge on both of those categories slightly, and I can see Ezzie's point. It's not that I can see certainly the merit in that. San Jose's depth defensemen, Brandon Dillon and Roman Polak, to me are an upgrade over Barrett Jackman and Anthony Potato. You saw that pairing getting taken advantage of yesterday. Top end, it's hard to argue with Nashville, right? It's hard to argue. But Mark Edward Vlasic, I thought, was tremendous last night. His recovery speed, his ability to get in the way and break up dangerous plays. Obviously, Brent Burns is that dominant power play. That one power play, they had the puck in the offensive zone for 2 minutes straight with that top unit. So I have San Jose in six because I think the forward groups here are pretty even. I really do. Rinne worries me, although he played well when he needed to in that first round. Mm-hmm. Jones, I'm not saying I'm entirely, he's Dominic Kassick, but I think you get a little more sturdy play there. And the San Jose depth on the back end, that's going to be the matchup that I think, San Jose 1-6, I really like that depth. And I think DeBoer is a good coach. I think Laviolette's a good coach as well. So I think the series is very close. But San Jose is also their second, and another factor here is their second tier guys is Couture, if you can consider him a second-tier guy. If you're going to say Thornton and Pavelski, that first line, and then, sure. Couture, second-tier guys.
Two goals for
Mike Ribeiro is a poor playoff performer. Let's just put that out
But
there.
I did think he was very good in game one, though.
He's better. He needed to be better. But he's a poor playoff performer. I mean, you indicated based upon the fact that...
Good in round one.
He never has been good in the playoffs.
Yeah.
And that's their secondary scoring on Nashville. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned other guys who have certainly contributed. And I do like their complementary players that are going to become more important, Arvidsson and Salamaki and all that. but it's the scorers, the next level scorers, and the depth on the four, on the defense. The next level scorers, meaning Marleau and Couture and all that, are better than Nashville. So I have San Jose in a series in six.
But Rich, you know, you mentioned that the second line of Mike Ribeiro hasn't been good throughout the playoffs, and I agree. And when you consider that Couture, Donskoy, and Joel Ward was their best line in game one, mm-hmm. and at times was their best line in the first round, because, I mean, in the first round, Joe Thornton, it's not like Joe Thornton racked up the points in the first round against LA, sure. right? I mean, they were getting contributions from other players.
He's got 3 points in their six games.
Right. And so when you look at this team right now, I would say that, and the series, I should say, the biggest difference, I think, is San Jose's got a top line, but Mike Ribeiro's got to step it up. Absolutely. He's a veteran guy. They brought him in last year and then signed him to a two-year contract after he was really good last year. But Richie's right. I mean, these are the key matchups, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you can't have your second-line center not producing offensively. And he wasn't very good in the first round. He's got to be better. And I think Pekka Rinne's got to be better. He struggled at times, wasn't good in game one. So I do think it's going to be a long series. I think, you know, Nashville will win some games. But ultimately, I mean, this San Jose team, I said it when we were doing our Stanley Cup preview show, Drew, I think this team is really motivated to prove people wrong. I think they wanted to erase the memory of that L.A. Come from behind 3-0 series deficit a couple of years back. And I think Pete DeBoer is an underrated coach. We've talked about that a lot. And Martin Jones is a pretty darn good goaltender as well. So this team, I think, is again, you talk about Dallas being underestimated a little bit. I think in this series, San Jose is being underestimated a little bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have a Sharks team playing with confidence in the playoffs, and when was the last time you can say that San Jose had confidence in the playoffs? And if they, you know, we know the talent's always been there. The question has been about sort of between their ears and the mental side of it. They get through the LA Kings relatively unscathed. They win game one. This team could be a snowball that's building up steam as it goes down the hill.
Well, Nashville struggled at home in round one, right? Sure. And if they're not careful, this series could be over in 4 or 5 games.
Well, you both had, to recap your predictions that you made before the play, this second round started, you both took San Jose in six in this series, off to a good start, winning game one. Previous predictions, Richie, you had the Dallas Stars in seven, Ezzy, you had the Blues in six, and you both had the Capitals in seven. Let's head to break. When we come back, we're going to bring in Adam Vingan. He is in San Jose covering the series for the Tennessean newspaper. We talk more about the Preds and the Sharks coming up next. Hour number three coming up here on TSN 1290.
Listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew, Ezra, and Richard return on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Hour number three of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel alongside Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the program Adam Vingan. Adam covers the Nashville Predators for the Tennessean newspaper. Adam, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Our pleasure, Adam. Obviously brought you on to talk about the Sharks and the Predators series. The Sharks drawing first blood last night with a 5-2 victory over the Preds. A score that was, I would say, misleading, given that this was a 1-0 Predators lead after 40 minutes. Third period last night, was it a function sort of the Sharks maybe getting their legs underneath them as a result of that long layover, and maybe the Predators, the seven-game series against the Ducks, catching up to them, leading to the Sharks being able to throw a few pucks past Pekka Rinne last night?
Perhaps, but the Predators are certainly in for a much different test against the Sharks than they had against the Ducks. The Ducks, of course, were a defensive-oriented team, which allowed them to resurrect their season during the second half. There wasn't a lot of space on the ice, and chances were scant. In this series, it looks like it's going to be a much more wide-open game, and the Sharks are so skilled and so fast that they can sort of overwhelm you if you let them, and that's what happened last night. I think the first 30 minutes, you could tell that the Sharks hadn't played in a week, plus there was the feeling out process between two teams playing in their first game of a playoff series. But once the Sharks got their legs moving in the second half of the second period through the rest of the game, they were dominant. You know, they were overwhelming. Nashville spending a lot of time in the offensive zone, rushing into the offensive zone without much restraint, and putting up a five spot, which includes two power play goals and two empty netters. The Sharks are actually the fifth team in NHL playoff history to score at least five goals in the third period after being held scoreless in the first two. So the Predators are going to be in for a very tough test. They had a 2-0 lead in their series against the Ducks, and all eight teams that won their first game in the first round won the series. You know, the Predators are going to need to tie this series up on Sunday. You know, the Sharks were the best road team in the NHL last this season, winning 28 games away from SAP Center. So going back to Nashville down 2-0 is very daunting for the Predators.
Adam, we were talking about this last segment. Mike Ribeiro, he hasn't had a very good playoffs this year. He's got one assist in eight games. I actually thought Mike Ribeiro had his best game of the playoffs last night. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but can this team go far? Can they get to the next round without their second-line center playing better?
Well, it's interesting because I didn't really notice Mike Ribeiro too much last night, and I think it's just because I wasn't used to noticing him in the first yeah. round. I mean, the Predators were able to get out of the first round against the Ducks with limited contributions from their top players. And Mike Ribeiro may have taken the cake as the worst player for the Predators in the first round. And the problem with that is when Mike Ribeiro isn't playing well, it affects Philip Forsberg, who's been his line mate all year, and Forsberg's been quiet in the playoffs as well. So for all intents and purposes, you need Mike Ribeiro to play well, but he's not strong in the dot. He's won 30% of his faceoffs in the playoffs, but you know he's never been a good faceoff player, so that's not necessarily a surprise. But you know the West is a much different animal, as we all know. It takes those big body centers like Ryan Johansson, for example, to really stand tall. I mean, Mike Ribeiro is a wiry guy. He's elusive, and he relies on skill to get around players. He's not going to use brute force because he's not a big guy. But I feel like that's a disadvantage for a team in the Western Conference playoffs.
You mentioned Ryan Johansson, and he was, I thought, really good last night, seeing the ice well, creating, having the assist on Mike Fisher's goal, scoring, you know, batting it out of the air for the second goal. Was that as good as you've seen him play in the playoffs so far?
Yeah, he's been good in the playoffs. He's got 5 points and had a really nice goal in the first round against Anaheim, a nice backhand goal. I think it was in game five. These games sort of all run together after a while. But, you know, this is what they got Ryan Johansson for. They got him to be the first line center, a big body, skillful center in the Western Conference playoffs. And I think he's been doing very well. I mean, he changes their entire team. I think his arrival, so not necessarily because of his production, but just because of his presence, I think helped the Predators in the second half of the season. By putting him in the lineup, I think everybody else fell into place around him, which allowed the Predators to play as well as they did in the second half of the season, one of the better records from February through the end of the regular season. So, you know, the more they can get from him, and as you mentioned, a great pass to Mike Fisher for the Predators' first goal last night, the more they get from him, the better.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Our guest is Adam Vingan. He covers the Nashville Predators for the Tennessean newspaper in Nashville. Adam, Colin Wilson, obviously very familiar to people here in Winnipeg. A lousy regular season, to be blunt, at times healthy scratched, yet he's had a fantastic playoff so far, leading the Predators with 6 points in their first eight playoff games. Why the turnaround, and you know, where did this Colin Wilson come from after being missing in action for 82 games of the regular season?
Well, what's interesting is that his nickname is on social media in Nashville is Playoff Colin Wilson, because he's just two different players between the regular season and the playoffs. Last season, he did score a career-high 20 goals in the regular season and then scored 5 goals in 6 games against the Blackhawks, which was a Predators single-series record for most goals. This season, as you mentioned, did a terrible regular season. 6 goals in almost 70 games, was a healthy scratch during a game against the Penguins in late March. But for whatever reason, he turns it on in the postseason. As you mentioned, he does lead the team with 6 points, and he's got that power forward game working. He's going hard to the net. And, you know, he's driving hard. I mean, that's the kind of game you need him to play. He wasn't really doing that a lot during the first half of the season. I think in the second half he was getting better at it, though he wasn't necessarily being rewarded for it. But you see the goal he scored in Game 7 against the Ducks. I mean, you've seen the plays that he's made around the net in the playoffs so far. Those are the kinds of plays they need Colin Wolfe to have, especially if Craig Smith is out. He missed two games, Craig Smith did, in the first round. Came back for Game 6 and 7. Did not play last night with a lower body injury. He is a player that it provides that secondary scoring you need in the postseason. So not to have him definitely hurt. They're 0-4 in games without him this playoff, including the game he got hurt. So Colin Wilson, in that absence, needs to step up even more.
Adam, I guess you'd probably agree that Shea Weber and Roman Josi didn't have their best games in Game 1 last night against the San Jose Sharks. Are you at all worried that the amount of hockey that they've played, that both of those guys play upwards of 30 minutes a game, do you think they're starting to tire down a little bit, or do you think that's ridiculous considering those are the big guns for the Nashville Predators on defense and they get paid the big bucks to shut down the opposing team's best players?
Yeah, that's the latter point is probably true. The interesting thing, I think, is Anson Carter may have said it last night on the NBC post-game show, that he thinks that the fact that Shea Weber and Roman Josi are playing so much time on the penalty kill is wearing them out unnecessarily, and I think that's a valid point. I mean, they play in every situation, and of course, the playing on the power play is different than playing on the penalty kill, you know. But they do have other penalties. They do have Matias Ekholm and Ryan Ellis and Barrett Jackman, who on the defensive side can eat up more penalty killing minutes, but. You know, they did a good job in the first round neutralizing Corey Perry and Ryan Getzlaf, but in the most part, I mean, they're going to get a keeping helping of Joe Thornton and company in this series. You know, it was not a good start for them or for anybody on the Predators last night. But, you know, these are, as you mentioned, that's why they're paid so much, and that's why they're probably the most heavily relied upon pair in the NHL, just in terms of the overall minutes that they play in all situations. So, and this is what they're paid to do, and that's what Pierre Laviolette's going to probably stick it to.
Is there a concern that Pekka Rinne, you know, that goal he lets in to tie the game in the third period there, is there a concern about his confidence at all?
I wouldn't think so, especially because of how he played in the first 40 minutes of the game, plus the last two games of the last series. He was phenomenal in Game 6 and 7 against the Ducks, making 62 saves on 64 shots, and he was making some great saves in the first 40 minutes, but... You know, you never like to go, well, he'd like to have that back, but that first goal by Tomas Hertl was one that not necessarily sure how he let that one go in. You know, the other ones, the Joel Ward breakaway was just, a beautiful move by Joel Ward, who we all know is a noted playoff performer, and then the deflection by Logan Couture in the power play, it was almost perfect. So I don't necessarily fault Pekka Rinne for that. Other than that first goal, I think that's the one you look at and say, that's probably the one he shouldn't have let in. But for as well as he played in the 40 minutes prior and in two games before that, I don't think there should be any concern.
You know, Adam, you watch this team, and to me, their depth is certainly, that their depth is, we talked about the second line issues, but the third and fourth lines, and especially Arvidsson and Salamaki seem to have given this team a boost with kind of youthful enthusiasm, but also a kind of a mix of skill and sandpaper. Are the Predators deeper and more better equipped to deal with San Jose's depth than maybe they have been in past years?
Yeah, I think this forward group may be the deepest that the Predators have had, arguably in their history. I mean, Arvidsson, I think, has had a really good season, and he made the team at a training camp last year. Was in the AHL, led the AHL in shots on goal, and was the Milwaukee Admirals' leading scorer. I think he had 56 points. So he's a perfect player for the system that the Predators play. And Mika Salamaki, who is most noted for the one player who concussed Dennis Wiedemann, which led to him cross-checking Don Henderson in that game.
That's what led to it.
Yeah, that is a hard hit by Mika Salamaki, and that's what he's known for hitting for a hard, clean hit. So, you know, he's been in the lineup regularly for several months, and I think he's a good addition to this team. He's got that pull in the China shot mentality. So, you know, they have those guys in the bottom six, especially because some of the players in the Predators' bottom six are older. Paul Gostad, Eric Nystrom. You know, the Predators have sort of a youth movement in that bottom six. They've also got Colton Sissons. They have Austin Watson. They have a lot of young players who can play those roles and are going to play those roles for many years.
Adam, trading Seth Jones earlier in the season to get Ryan Johansson obviously made the Predators better up the middle, gave them that number one center that they've needed for so long. But are we starting to see the lack of D on that, pardon me, lack of depth on that third D pairing where you would maybe have Seth Jones and now you've, well, you probably have Seth Jones in your top four actually, but are we starting to see the lack of depth there with Anthony Boteto and Bear Jackman who struggled quite a bit in game one?
Yeah, when you know the Predators are probably the only team in the NHL that could have removed a defenseman like Seth Jones from their roster and been okay, and they did. I mean, when you have a top four of Yossi, Weber, Ekholm, and Ellis, you're in pretty good shape. But that means that third pair, which was a commodity with Seth Jones on it before he left, now it's sort of it's not necessarily a liability, but it's not as strong as it once was. And you know, Bear Jackson and Anthony Boteto haven't had the greatest playoffs overall, but you don't need them to play a lot of minutes. But yes, you've seen them struggle overall, which is why it's a good thing that you've got two pairs that can eat a lot of minutes above them. So, you know, it is certainly interesting. You know, Anthony Boteto in the time that Seth Jones was on the roster only played in one game between October and January, and has become, you know, a regular in the lineup. But, you know, he's a solid player. He's got more of an offensive skill set than a defensive one. But you know, you pair him with Bear Jackman, who's a steady hand, and you know, in his older age, so you know, it's not a bad pair, but yeah, the drop off between first, second, and third is a lot more drastic than it once was.
Adam Vingan covers the Nashville Predators for the Tennessean newspaper. He joins us from San Jose, where the Predators and Sharks are doing battle in round two. Game number two goes tomorrow down in California. Adam, really appreciate your time this morning. Thanks very much for joining us on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Anytime. Thanks very much.
Appreciate it, Adam. Let's head to break. When we come back, we look at the final second round playoff series, the Islanders and the Lightning. You're listening to Illegal Curve Hockey on TSN 1290.
The Curve Crew are back. It's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Shot. He scores! A power play goal for John Tavares, 4-1 Islanders.
That Tavares power play goal proved to be the game-winning goal. The Lightning staged a comeback, but fell short of doing so. The Islanders score into an empty net, and they win game one by a 5-3 margin. I believe that game one happened about 3 weeks ago, if I'm not mistaken.
Forget that for a second, Drew. I mean, yeah, they have to space it out because of the scheduling with the arenas and such.
Is it the arenas or TV, do you think?
No, I believe it's the arenas that are unavailable.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was my understanding. John Tavares, next level. Next level. We talk about players who haven't... To me, you know, you look at, you know, Joe Thornton might be the year that he conquers demons or whatever it may be. And certain guys who haven't done it. But the performance you're asking for, you know, even Corey Perry in that last game, and he's won a cup, granted, but the performance you're asking for is the performance you saw from John Tavares in Game 7.
Game 6.
Game 6, sorry, is what I meant.
That entire series, entire first-round series against the Panthers.
And he even played that particularly well early in that Game 6 game. Yes, the entire series, Drew. But that is where that's where superstars are born. That's where you get to watch the best of the best. It's a pleasure to watch skill like that. Just want to put it out there. I mean, that's as good a performance you're going to see, as clutch a performance you're going to see, scoring a goal with a minute left in Game 6, scoring an amazing goal in double overtime.
The balance to stay on his skates, because, I mean, Aaron Ekblad's no small boy.
Oh, I know.
Aaron Ekblad's going to win a Norris Trophy in his career. And he, you know, tried to knock Tavares off his skates, you know, as he was rounding the net there. And Tavares shook him off and tucked it in on the wraparound and, you know, propelling the Islanders into a second-round matchup against the Lightning here. John Tavares, to your point, Richie, has been fantastic in these playoffs.
And John Tavares had a poor regular season by John Tavares' standards, and that's maybe why you know, not as many people were high on the New York Islanders heading into the playoffs here, but he's been excellent. I agree with Richie. He's playing at the regular level that you're expecting out of him. I thought that the defense was really good for the New York Islanders, but I thought the Islanders were tenacious in their forecheck.
Yes, they were.
And they're led by Cizikas, Clutterbuck, Martin, and that's their fourth line. I thought that obviously Shane Prince was excellent in that game on the third line there, and they haven't got a lot of secondary scoring so far in the playoffs. They've relied a lot on the Nielsen, Tavares, Oposo line. You know, they've got some contributions from other players, but I thought they were just all over the Tampa Bay Lightning. And, you know, you consider that Ryan Pulock might be available later in the series. He was injured in the first round.
Well, Zidlicky played pretty well in his absence, I thought, at least in the end of the Florida series.
Yeah, Zidlicky's going to play limited minutes on the third pair there, usually with Calvin DeHaan. You're right, Rich. He has been good, kind of giving that veteran presence. He's been in the playoffs for a long time. I think you got to give Jack Capuano a lot of credit, not only for taking a puck in the nose,
a puck to the face,
but you know he's put Travis Hamonic up there with Nick Leddy, and I thought they completely shut down the Tampa Bay top line. And you know Tampa Bay, you know, was very dominant against the Detroit Red Wings. Mm-hmm. And you know, did Ben Bishop have his best game? No. Thomas Greiss didn't have to be excellent. He just had to be okay, because the New York Islanders definitely ran away with that game as the game progressed. But I think this is going to be a back-and-forth series. I really do. I think it's going to probably go to seven games. I like the Islanders. Whatever I pick them, Islanders in six or Islanders in seven, doesn't matter. It's going to go six or seven.
Ezzy, to answer your question, you have the Islanders in six. Richie, you have the Lightning in six.
Yeah, and I had the Islanders in the first round, and you know, this is probably the one I feel, I don't feel, in the second round, I don't feel as much as I did the first round, but I have the Lightning in six here, although I don't feel as confident maybe in this one as some other ones. I'll tell you why. The reason I picked the Lightning is because the Islanders' secondary scoring was a big flaw for them in that first round series, and I thought that'd be an issue because, you know, the Lightning will have your top line, which has been pretty dominant. Kucherov and company have been pretty dominant. So if those top lines offset and you have Hedman in play, the Lightning's other group, you know, other forwards, I thought would be able to offset kind of the Islanders' forwards. And then I think Greiss has been really good, but Bishop's had a tremendous year. Mm-hmm. And
Vezina nominee.
Absolutely. And in Tampa, I think I know you don't have Stroman, but Hedman being, you know, that good, I think a little bit of an overall edge I gave to Tampa slightly. They're going to have home ice advantage. So with all that being said, I had Tampa in six. But one thing, a couple of things about the Islanders that would concern me with my pick, you know, as you mentioned, Hamonic, I think he's been excellent. Greiss has been excellent. But they roll four lines, and they're consistent in rolling four lines. And that could serve them well down the stretch here, not overloading on guys and giving them too much responsibility. I thought the biggest key for the Islanders' perspective, if I'm an Islanders fan, I'm most encouraged by Ryan Strome coming back into the lineup after being a healthy scratch and accumulating two assists and being an offensive contributor, because those kind of guys need to be contributors. Him, Brock Nelson, you mentioned it, Shane Prince earlier, guys like that need to be contributing, because the fourth line, you know what you're getting, and the first line, you know what you're getting. It's the two and three that have been issues.
Sure, and I mean, you have Shane Prince performing, you know, Shane Prince, who was acquired from the Ottawa Senators at the trade deadline. You know, the Senators giving up on a young player. I mean, certainly he's still quite, what is he, 23 years old? And so the Senators probably regretting that move, because Shane Prince has sort of had a, you know, a bit of a coming out party, in that he's certainly been effective for the New York Islanders.
Certainly been a coming out party for
him. Yeah, you know, coming in and, you know, performing well both against the Panthers and then having a good game against the, in you know, the two goals in game one against the Lightning.
Alan Quine, too. I mean, there's been a lot of guys who kind of had coming out parties here for the Islanders. And John Cooper's adjustments are going to be interesting here. I mean, the Tampa had been off for some time, and the Islanders just seem to take that momentum, even though. And that goes back to the four lines, because if you play that much overtime, you have to be. You have to. If you've relied on your depth, which Florida hadn't, right? Like, if you, at the end of that series, Florida's playing three lines all the time, really, most of the series. So, had they even won game six, how much more would they have had in the tank after a couple double overtime playing three lines? So the Islanders come in, as he, for a team that's played six really hard hard games, plus all the overtimes, basically seven games, the fact that they're rolling those lines, I think, helped them into that first game with Tampa.
And, Rich, you really see how much Tampa Bay misses Anton Stroman, a good defensive defenseman, and as far as I'm concerned, even though the Tampa Bay Lightning, I think, are going to score goals, Tyler Johnson, Kucherov, and Killorn has been an excellent line in the playoffs, and Palat, Filppula, and Drouin was good in that game one as well. But as far as I'm concerned, if Hedman and Matt Carl can't shut down the Tavares line, they don't have a chance in this series, because to what we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. that line right now is clicking. And Franz Nielsen, who was usually the second-line center for this New York Islanders team, he's moved to the left wing of the first line with Tavares and Okposo, and Nelson is now centering that second line.
They'll play around with that depending on how much success they have, but yeah, that's generally what they do.
Yeah, and I just think that that line right now is the key. If I'm John Cooper, I'm focusing on that line, and you saw Palat up with Johnson and Kucherov at practice mm-hmm. yesterday. That's the triplets line, of course, so maybe they bump Killorn to the second line with Filppula and Drouin to try to maybe switch things up a little bit, but I think it is going to come down to depth, and Tampa Bay does have good depth. I mean, guys like Cedric Paquette and Ryan Callahan, Brian Boyle, fourth line center there,
it's
with Condra and Blunden.
It's pretty even.
They have depth too, yeah. But right now, I think this Islanders team is clicking a lot more. I think the Lightning had it a little bit easy. In that first-round matchup against the Detroit Red Wings, that Red Wings team limped into the playoffs, Drew. Mm-hmm. And this Islanders team, I think, has saved their best for last, and they're really clicking. So they've got to elevate their game. Because in game one, sure, you know, they did score three goals, but I didn't think that they were particularly good. I think the Islanders used their speed a lot better than Tampa did, so
yeah, well,
it's going to be a good series.
You know, when you're down 4-1, I think that's more important than the fact that they came back and you made it 4-3.
I think the other thing just to note before we wrap up the segment here is this Islanders core has been together. You heard Okposo talk about it after the Game 6. It's been together for a long time.
Sure.
And Okposo's a pending UFA. Franz Nielsen's a pending UFA. Travis Hamonic has asked for a trade. They may think this is their last run at it as a group, and I think they're kind of playing that way.
Sure. Quickly, one last thing. Josh Bailey, not in the lineup. He left the game.
Josh Bailey, not in the lineup. I mean, the guy's done nothing. He hasn't worn a spot in the lineup.
So you know.
Doesn't worn a spot. He hasn't done nothing. He's been thoroughly disappointing. He does not deserve to be in the lineup.
There you have it. Let's go to break. When we come back, we do some more post-mortems regarding the other teams eliminated in the first round of the playoffs. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
Listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew, Ezra, and Richard return on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Eleven:30 in the morning. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Our apologies. We were going to have Tri-City Storm draft-eligible prospect Wade Allison. Wade, of course, being from Manitoba. We were going to have him on the program. He's been called into a team meeting. So we're hoping to have Wade on with us next week, so you can stay tuned for that. I also should have mentioned the previous segment was brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey. This segment brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, officially declared the funniest place in Winnipeg by Illegal Curve Hockey. For 30 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. Tonight at Rumors, her final night in town, Carmen Lynch, and just announced Piff the Magic Dragon. You know him as a finalist from America's Got Talent. He is a comedian magician. Tickets just on sale coming up at the end of June to see Piff the Magic Dragon at Rumors. Check him out and a list of all performers at rumorscomedyclub.com.
Maybe Piff the Magic Dragon can saw you in half, Drew.
It's possible. I would hope not, but you know, I don't know that I necessarily want to be sawed in half. But
he's not actually going to saw you in half.
You sure?
He's a magician. That's the magic part of it. He'll make us think that he's cutting you in half, but really your body is just, you know, behind your or whatever they do or whatever. I mean, apparently he's a very funny guy, and get tickets to it.
Yes, get tickets to that. Well said, Ezzy. The Minnesota Wild, let's talk about them. They're one of the teams that were defeated in the first round. No real surprise there. They lose in six games to the Dallas Stars. You know, probably make it closer than a lot of people expected, really, you know, a centimeter away from tying up that game and, you know, maybe having it go back to Dallas for a critical game seven. But John Torchetti, who has been the Minnesota Wild head coach since Mike Yeo was fired earlier in the season, he's been their interim head coach. You know, he received a, I wouldn't say that it's an overwhelming, I would say it's sort of a lukewarm endorsement from Chuck Fletcher in regards to if Torchetti will be their head coach going forward. A lot of talk now that Bruce Boudreau being on the market and out of Anaheim, he'd be a fit in in Minnesota as the head coach of the Wild. How do you see the Wild head coaching search playing out? Is this a Wild team that's still trending upwards, or is this a team that's on a downward trend, you know, at the end of their 2015-16 regular season?
That's a really good question. I mean, their back end's really solid. You have Spurgeon, Scandella, Suter, Brodin, and then you have Riley and Dumba. I mean, Dumba's contract's going to be interesting because those four players, not excluding Riley, are signed long-term to fairly big money. So they have some interesting decisions to make on the back end. But if you feel good about Dubnyk and there's not really anything to dislike about the back end or overwhelmingly dislike about the back end, the question then gets to your forwards. That's why I don't necessarily think, and I know Anaheim played a really defensively successful season, but usually Boudreaux's teams are more offensively adept. So you wonder if they're going to go back to more of a defensive structure, maybe not as much structure as Yeo, almost too structured, but mm-hmm. a defensive coach based upon the way the roster has been built. Up front, I see the team with getting older. You have Pominville, and you have Koivu, and you have Parise. You have guys up there that, talented players, no doubt, but not in their primes anymore. So you're, as I said before, you're a little slower up front. You're not the most physical group up front. You have some young players, but you need more. So I don't think they're trending down. I don't know if they're trending up. I think they're probably staying the same. And so coaching may be extra important here due to the fact that you might need to get more out of this group than just any regular coach who has the top-end team just needs to make sure he coaches that talent, doesn't get in the way. Here you have to coach up.
Ezzy, before I let you get in here, here is Minnesota Wild general manager Chuck Fletcher speaking to the media.
So we haven't had any opportunity to speak about the future, to speak about what his vision would be, what he would like to do systems-wise, how he wants to push this team forward. So we're going to have those conversations in the near future. I'm looking forward to them. The great thing is I know John. I know his personality. I know his work ethic. We don't have to spend a lot of time like you would do in a normal interview, getting to know each other. It's just about how his vision and my vision align. And
that's Chuck Fletcher speaking about John Torchetti and the possibility of him getting the interim tag removed from his name and being the head coach full-time of the Minnesota Wild.
Yeah, and it remains to be seen, Drew, if Torchetti's coming back or if they're going to go outside the organization and bring in a new head coach, because as you mentioned, he was brought in on an interim basis. I agree with Rich. I mean, before the season started, I picked the Wild to go to the Stanley Cup Finals. I had to change that before the playoffs started just because the Wild, I thought, were completely overmatched by the Dallas Stars. I thought a great example of the difference between the Wild and the Stars is how fragile the Wild were when Parise went out of the lineup as opposed to the Dallas Stars when Sagan went out of the lineup and they have other guys that step up. So whether it's Jason Spezza on the second line or whether it's Radek Faksa and Alex Hemsky on the third line, they had other guys that have stepped up. But to Richie's point, I mean, I realize Jason Pominville had a good playoffs and he led the Wild in scoring, but he wasn't very good during the season. And the players that they needed to step it up in the playoffs were the same players that didn't step it up in the regular season. So you're talking about guys like Mikael Granlund, who I really like his skill set, but he's the type of player, do they know what they have there? I think they expected him to take over the number one center role, right, Rich? And he just wasn't able to do it. I still think when you compare the Minnesota Wild to the elite teams in the Western Conference, they're not strong enough up the middle. And I realize Mikko Koivu, the captain, he's a good player, good veteran. But, I mean, Mikko Koivu's best offensive years, no offense to him, are behind him. Even though, again, he was particularly good in the playoffs, especially in the games that the Wild won, right? Because the Wild almost took it to that seventh game. But this Wild team, I agree with Rich. I don't think you're going to completely revamp this team. You have a lot of money tied up in Parise and Suter, but Ryan Suter, I thought, had a very good season. Offensively, had his best year ever. And I agree with Rich. Dubnyk, he's your goalie, and you've committed money long term to him, but you do need to change up the makeup of this team a little bit. I think this team is flawed. I think it's one of those teams that they keep the games low scoring. They have enough talent to win games. You saw the Jets in the Wild. They seem to always play one goal games, but there's something about this team. There is something missing. And when I look at what the Jets are doing, bringing in a guy like Kyle Connor, they might have a 2016 first-round pick in their lineup. The Jets are trending up, and I agree with Rich. The Wild right now, I think, have flatlined a little bit, and they're a team that their veteran players aren't able to do what they used to do. And, you know, even though the defense is very strong, one of the stronger defenses in the league, in the playoffs, they couldn't go toe-for-toe with the Dallas Stars as far as their speed, and they couldn't go toe-for-toe with them in their special teams.
That's right.
There was nothing that the Minnesota Wild had that was overmatching what the Dallas Stars had. So I think, you know, Chuck Fletcher has work to do, not only the coach, Drew, but he has to look at his team and address weaknesses. And we've talked about it before. Power play has been a problem in Minnesota for how many years now? 10 years? They've never really had a good power play. And again, you have to look at some of these players and say, are these guys top six players? Like, is Charlie Coyle, Jason Zucker, are these guys top six players? Should they be maybe better suited for third line roles? Do they need to maybe move somebody at the draft and try to move up in the draft? Because they're not going to have a high first round pick, right? So I think Chuck Fletcher has a lot of work to do.
Well, let me read this quote. This comes from Elliot Friedman's column, his 30 Thoughts, and he's talking to Chuck Fletcher, the Wild general manager. Chuck Fletcher admitted that, quote, it was a brutal year, but he is angry at suggestions that the Wild did not try. Quote, we had to fight to get into the playoffs, including win a big game at Colorado. We fought right to the end against Dallas. What Fletcher does believe is that, quote, they did not buy in, the players did not buy in to how we wanted them to play. How does Chuck Fletcher want this Minnesota Wild team to play? That's the question that I have for you, because it doesn't seem like one way or the other that they have an overwhelming philosophy there.
I don't know what it is either.
Isn't that on the general manager to some extent then?
I mean, he let go of the coach and brought in an interim guy who's kind of going to have his own way. So you'll see with this hire here. But at a bigger level, Drew, at a more macro level, you look at it and you say, okay, the problems that they're going to be facing right now have been created contractually by Fletcher a little bit here. So he's going to have to dig himself out of a little bit of a hole. Now, Vanek's contract expires after next season. So, I mean, the question about style, I think it plays into what we were talking about the deficiencies of the roster.
Sure.
And so do I think the team didn't try? You never say a team didn't try. At least it's hard for us to say, certainly from this far away, even from here in Winnipeg. I mean, to say some team didn't try, we don't do that because it's really impossible. We're not sitting in that room for us to say. You know, if you don't like the effort of a team on one night, okay. But for a team to not try continually is I think, something that I'm not surprised he took issue with.
So the Minnesota Wild are a team that, you know, it seems like they're just sort of in a holding pattern at this point in time until Fletcher decides how he wants to proceed with them and in what avenue, you know, in what manner.
I mean, the first question was that if he was going to be the guy proceeding with him, I mean, we thought here that he would probably be let go as a result of this poor season and the roster kind of lacking direction.
Are you surprised that he got the vote of confidence?
I'm surprised, yes.
That you know, that he is the guy to, you know, he's built this lineup and now he's the guy to almost tweak it or rebuild it, whatever.
I'm surprised. I'm not saying, he ought to have been fired, but I'm surprised that he wasn't let go.
It seems he's almost untouchable there, given some of the curious decisions the Wild have made over the last
number
of years.
He's close with the Craig Leopold, I'm pretty sure, and when Leopold took over the squad, That's who he appointed. So there's a connection there, no doubt.
Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll look at some of the other teams that were eliminated in the first round. And we'll ask producer Rory what's going on with his headwear today. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
We're on the curve. The Illegal Curve. Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
One final segment Saturday morning here on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg with you. It's brought to you by the Riverview Health Center Foundation Cycle on Life. The Legal Curve is thrilled to be participating in this fine event coming up on June the 5th. Join IC in raising money for the Riverview Health Center's Alzheimer's and Dementia Wards by cycling in the event or contributing to Team Illegal Curve. For more information about the Riverview Health Center Foundation Cycle on Life or to join Team Illegal Curve, visit rhcf.mb.ca. Time is running out to register for the event. Got to raise some cash and help support the Riverview Health Center. It's coming up only 5 weeks away, guys. You guys have both been in training, you know, cycling a lot during the off season. How do you feel? You guys feeling ready to go June the 5th cycling? Rich, I know you were a little apprehensive last week about potentially falling off the bike.
Yeah, I'm still concerned about that.
Really, it hasn't changed at all.
No.
Were you not a bike rider as a kid?
Yeah, but I gave up bike riding very early.
Yeah.
So I went for a bike ride with Ezzy last year on some retro bikes, and Dave Manuk on some retro bikes. But yeah, it wasn't the most sturdy, so it should be an interesting ride.
Okay. Well,
how many? It's five steps. Is that what it is?
Five steps.
Yeah.
Like you think the bike ride is five steps?
Yeah. Or is it? How long is it?
What is a step? I don't understand what five steps
means.
That's
probably as long as I'm going to be able to, like, five steps on your feet until I fall over.
Well, fortunately, it supports the Riverview Health Center Foundation, Riverview Health Center Hospital. So if you do fall off the bike there, you will have good emergency care available for you. But I'm confident.
An attitude like that, I might fall off into your bike, Drew.
And take me out with you.
Bet.
But I'm confident that you'll be okay. Ezzy, I know you're an avid cyclist.
As long as I'm able to eat an Illegal Curve sandwich while I'm cycling, I'll be okay.
I think, you know, like in the Tour de France, they have like the teammates who like come up and like hand you water.
Yeah.
I think somebody's going to cycle up and hand you an Illegal Curve sandwich.
For this race, are we going to have like in the Tour de France when they have like cars, like their team?
That's what I'm saying.
Car? Are we going to have like our own team car of like people like throwing like donuts at us and throwing like pizza at us while we're racing?
Drew, do you bike though? I mean, aside from, you know, partaking in this annually, do you ever bike?
No, but I mean, yeah. I know how to bike. That
you
I
did
won't
go for a run last night.
I did, that was two nights ago, but yes.
Nobody saw you ever run.
Well, do you want to? I mean, you can follow behind me if you would like. I mean, you can.
Well, I don't want to. We don't want that visual.
Are we going to get to Rory's hat or not?
Well, we can get to Rory's hat now. I mean, the NFL draft is going on, of course. It started, I think, 3 weeks ago as well with the first round and, you know, the gas mask bong scandal.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. With my favorite sports scandal in the last little while. But I walked into the studio this morning with Rory, and I got to give him props. Rory, you know, turn around your hat, show it to Rich and Ez, because it's hard to believe that somebody in this day and age would be proudly wearing a Cleveland Browns hat.
Well, it does take some courage.
It takes some courage, is right, to be publicly admitting your fandom of the Cleveland Browns.
Yeah,
it's been a long, long time period.
Some dark years in the dog pound.
Yes,
for sure.
Some dark years in the dog pound, is right. You know, would you wear a Cleveland Browns hat right now there, Ez?
I've never been a fan of the Cleveland Browns, but I have nothing... I have nothing against the Cleveland Browns. It's funny. I didn't know what hat that was. I didn't know what you were talking about. I actually thought it might have been a Detroit Red Wings hat because it's kind of a grayish hat. But quite frankly, I don't know why Drew threw Rory under the bus for this one.
I wasn't throwing him. I was giving him props. I did not throw him under the bus at all. This is a guy who through the darkest days of a franchise has stayed loyal. And I think that's impressive. I mean, there's no way, I don't know how old you are, Rory, but there's no way that the Cleveland Browns have had any success in the course of your lifetime.
No. Not since I've liked them.
Yeah, exactly. And
not
I mean,
a single time.
So you picked a team that was actually at the bottom of the barrel, continues to be at the bottom of the barrel, and decided that's going to be my team.
Yeah, I like the simplicity of the whole team. Orange helmet for a logo, Browns, nothing special.
Always losing. There's some simplicity there as well.
Yeah.
I mean, so I was giving Rory props. I wasn't throwing him under the bus whatsoever.
Cool.
Yeah. Other teams that need a post-mortem at the end of the first round. You know, we did the Minnesota Wild. We did the Anaheim Ducks. The Chicago Blackhawks, I mean, obviously they lost in seven games, so there's no grave concerns with the Blackhawks. Do they need to address the depth on their back end this offseason? Is that the priority for Stan Bowman? Will they be able to do so given their salary cap jail that they find themselves in on a perennial basis?
Yeah, they're going to try to address it, Drew. And I think a guy like Trevor Van Riemsdyk struggled on the second pair for Chicago. But as you mentioned, I mean, the Chicago Blackhawks are one game away from going to the second round. I think the amount of hockey that the Chicago Blackhawks played caught up to them a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I think losing a guy like Johnny Oduya did hurt them, certainly. But I don't think the Chicago Blackhawks team is going to be hurting at all. I mean, I don't expect Andrew Ladd to come back. Artemi Panarin has a year left on his first contract that he signed with the Chicago Blackhawks. So I wouldn't expect the makeup of this team to change too much. You hear a guy like Andrew Shaw might be moved out due to salary cap constraints. But, I mean, this Blackhawks team, I think they'll come back and they'll be fine next year. A guy like Van Riemsdyk is still young enough that he can grow as a defenseman. And, you know, the Blackhawks, even though you'd like them maybe to bring in a veteran, that might not happen. I still think that next year they'll be right there. They'll be competing with the Blues and the Stars for the Central Division crown. So I'm not as concerned. I'm concerned maybe that they're not as dominant of a team and their window for winning the Cups is closed somewhat. But when you consider that guys like Kane and Taves and Panarin are still relatively young, maybe Hossa's getting a little bit up there, Richie, in age. But
37, yeah.
For the most part, I mean, this team is still going to be good for years to come. Maybe not as good as they once were.
No, I agree. I agree with you. I mean, the defense is something they need to work on. Obviously, being at 65.8 on the cap for next year puts you up against it.
Yeah, and that's only with 17 guys on your
roster.
Yeah,
so I mean, that's what puts you up against it. But I do see them making a move on the back end. And as he mentions, you know, Andrew Shaw, him being an RFA, does his contract lead him to be possibly traded for that defenseman? Or does it, you know, Brian Bickle's a contract they'd love to rid themselves of. That's another one. But there's not a ton of flexibility here in terms of guys. Like, I, you know, it's not like there's a bunch of guys on the roster. Like, they're top heavy, so there's not many guys to trade here. I don't know if Teravainen is somebody they want to move. I mean, young player, still cheap deal. Panarin obviously is going to make it big on his contract after this next one, not this season, this summer, but next summer. Their only real piece that they have to move off the active roster is probably, you'd think, probably Shaw, maybe Teravainen. And then, so that's what, to me, that's what it would have to be likely now. They do have a young player in the system in Schmaltz, who, unless I'm making that error as to who drafted him, but that could be somebody you can bring in a youthful exuberance and help. I'm not sure if he's declared, so I apologize if he's declared he's going back to UND or not. But overall, there's not a lot of flexibility, but how much room is there to improve? I mean, they're a pretty dominant squad.
They are a pretty pretty dominant squad. I mean, nobody's saying that they're going to, you know, not be a playoff team or anything along those lines. I think that 65.8, I don't even think that includes the Panarin bonus overage that's going to be a factor coming next season as well. So it's a difficult offseason.
That's what I'm saying. Like, they're not going to be able to sign a guy likely that's going to have impact, plus they have to make a move.
Right. But, I mean, the question is, you're right, you know, it's a difficult decision to have to make because I don't know that, you know, Teravainen was disappointing this year.
Just to clarify, Schmaltz hasn't declared whether he's coming out or not. I think he would go right into that roster. Ezzie and I both saw him play this year, very good centerman, so he would certainly help improve their offensive game and maybe allow them to have the depth to be able to move a guy like we're talking about.
Sure, like Teravainen or something along those lines.
Yeah.
Both the other two teams we haven't spoken about, the Philadelphia Flyers and the Florida Panthers, I think from the Panthers' perspective, they, you know, it's a successful year, even though it's a disappointing first-round exit. No real significant changes there. You might look at, you know, improving that fourth line, because you mentioned it earlier in the show, as that they only really were rolling three lines in the course of the playoffs. So they're a team that's looking to update the depth. And for the Flyers, again, unexpected playoff appearance this year. So you took the Capitals to six games. You're probably happy with that. Not any sort of, you know, there's no button that needs to be pushed there in terms of rebuilding or rejigging any of those lineups. You're probably pretty happy with how those seasons ended up in both of those two cities.
Yeah, I think Florida, they got beat by the better team, even though Florida was at times the better team in the series, and Thomas Greiss was excellent. But yeah, there's a lot of good things there. Vincent Trocheck, if he's healthy the entire series, maybe the series is different, right? Mm-hmm. But very good on defense, led by Aaron Ekblad. And you know, Luongo didn't have his best series, let's be honest. Luongo was their MVP during the season. Jágr, I thought, was not very effective in the series against the Islanders either, and he was very effective on that top line for most of the season with Jonathan Huberdeau and Alexander Barkov, but they're trending in the right direction. I mean, that's a Florida Panthers team that was struggling especially, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. So they've turned it around. Barkov and Bukestad are excellent centers, and there's a lot to be excited about if you're a Panthers fan.
And on the Flyers angle there, you know, that back end looking so great. You know, Gossett's bared a tremendous season. You look at the other defensive prospects that they have in Ivan Provorov right now playing for the Brandon Wheat Kings in the playoffs. And
shout out to the Wheaties off to the Western Conference, off to the WHL Finals against Seattle now.
And they have lots to look forward to, and they really had success for guys like Voracek not having their best years. So Dave Haxel did a really nice job there in his first season in Philadelphia. So overall, both those teams, I think, you have to be pretty encouraged.
That's it for this Saturday morning in the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Big thanks to Chuck Gormley, covers the Washington Capitals. Mike Heike covers the Dallas Stars. And Adam Vingan, who covers the Nashville Predators. Big thank you to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, Zappia Group Realty, the Riverview Health Center Foundation, Cycle on Life, Keener Jerseys, and Bell Acres and Clear Lake Golf Courses. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com. For producer Rory, for Richard Pollock, for Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Stay tuned to TSN 1290. We have Blue Jays baseball and draft lottery coverage coming up later today on this fine radio station.